compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. And as ever, thank you for listening. As you might imagine, my name is Patrick Madrid, and I've got a lot I want to talk to you about. I want to start off with a story that caught my attention in the New York Post. A Long Island man who hasn't paid his mortgage in 23 years doesn't qualify for pandemic housing protections because he's been staying in the home illegally, a judge has ruled. Squatting, that's the popular term for it. Guramit Hanspal, that's his name, 52 years old. He bought the three-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath home in 1998 for $290,000, making a single mortgage payment before the house was foreclosed upon in 2000. So let me repeat that for you so you have the scenario. So he buys the house, 1998, $290,000. He makes one payment on this house, and then they foreclose on it because he stops making the payment. He stays put. He files multiple bankruptcies. He files lawsuits in various courts in a never-ending and thus far successful bid to stave off eviction. I remember talking about this story once before. This story has sort of popped up again, and I just want to refresh your memory and mine about what this actually means. This is an issue of justice. So to go back over the story again, I think I talked about it briefly when it first came out in the news, but he's filing all these lawsuits against the bank. He's going bankrupt over and over again, and he's living in this house. So he's staying in this house for 23 years consecutively without ever paying a dime. Can you imagine if you were the landlord or if you were holding the paper for this loan and this guy gets free housing essentially forever for the next 23 years? The East Meadow home, at that time at least, was owned by a company called Diamond Ridge Partners, which had been trying to oust him before pandemic-inspired eviction moratorium set in and created an historic housing court backlog. So he had that to his advantage as well. So you've got, you know, just who knows how many millions of people who are in the court system now facing evictions or foreclosures or what have you. So Bhagwant Srichawla, I do believe I'm saying that correctly, is another resident there. He and Mr. Hanspal, according to a representative for Diamond Ridge Partners, says, as this matter continued winding its serpentine meandering way through the state and federal court systems, they continued to live in this house. The forms created by Albany legislators to help keep hard-hit tenants from being ousted due to financial hardships during the pandemic have served as an automatic pause on most evictions. Lawyers for Hanspal and Srichawla, who was killed in a car crash not that long ago, they contended that Diamond Ridge shouldn't get to move ahead of countless other small landlords who are waiting their turn in court, to which Hohauser, one of the attorneys, noted with some dismay that Diamond Ridge and its predecessors have been waiting for more than two decades. If you can believe that, can you imagine all of the flack, all of the dust that this guy threw up in the air to evade the consequences of not paying his bills? You paid one mortgage payment. While there's scant case law on whether filing the hardship declaration alone can keep a landlord from evicting a tenant, the form shouldn't apply to Hanspal because he's not a tenant, so they say. The protections of the COVID declaration adhere to tenants, but not to those who have no financial obligation, including people who illegally stay in a home despite a foreclosure, who could be considered occupants at sufferance, if not outright squatters. I mean, he seems to me to be the poster boy for a squatter. Hanspal's behavior, which reflects no payment of any kind for decades, augurs strongly against any protection. This is from the government in terms of protecting those who are in danger of losing the homes that they're renting because of COVID. Diamond Ridge is very satisfied with the court's decision, said lawyer Jordan Katz, adding, we intend on immediately enforcing the court's order and ending this illegal occupancy. An attorney for Hanspal didn't return a message. An attorney representing the other guy declined comment. So here we have these guys, just to recap it. who figured out a way to game the system and to live for free in what, by all appearances, is a rather nice home, 3 bedrooms, 2.5 bath. They bought it for $290,000 in 1998. I haven't looked it up on Zillow, but I have a feeling it's appreciated quite handsomely. So they've lived in this house all this time for free. And it just boggles the mind that it would come to this before the owner of the house would be able to get them out. But that gets to the issue of justice. And that's what I wanted to talk a little bit about. The idea of justice is it's in everything we do. You know, when you go in to buy groceries or buy anything for that matter, in justice, you have to pay the price that's due. You can't steal, in other words. And that's, in essence, what these guys were doing. They've been stealing all this time. They've been stealing, not mooching. Mooching is, you know, where you're couch surfing, for example, or you're getting some handouts for food from friends or somebody. And, you know, maybe you don't even really need it, but you're too lazy to work in some cases. That's what typically moochers do. But in this case, with impunity, they have just been sucking up the benefit of living in this house. And that's an injustice. So that gets, I think, to the heart of an issue that touches on your life and mine. And that is, how do you live a just life? How do you receive justice? How do you give justice? Now, in a strict sense, one of the key definitions for justice is that people get what they deserve. You get what you deserve. And we see counterpoints to that. So, for example, in the story where Jesus is telling the parable of the workers in the vineyard, you know that story in the gospel where we're told that the master of the vineyard, he hires a bunch of people to go work in the vineyard early in the morning, and off they go. He says, here's what I'll pay you for your day's wage. And they go off into the vineyard and they toil. And then later that morning, he hires more people. I'll pay you. Go in there and work. They go. Midday, mid-afternoon. So by the end of the shift, by the end of the day, I would presume probably the sun is not far from going down. And he hires another batch of people. Late in the day, with very little time left to work, he sends them into the vineyard. And when they are finished, I guess around the time that the sun goes down, I can't work anymore, they all come out to get payment. And those who were toiling from the very beginning, they were shocked to discover that the owner of the vineyard paid the people who went in at the very end. And who knows, maybe they only worked 20 minutes, something very minimal. And they get paid the same amount that the people who had worked in the vineyard got paid. And by our way of reckoning things, that would be an injustice. And this is why Jesus turns this on its head. And there's a reason why he does that. I'll share that with you in just a minute. So if you're thinking of justice the way we typically think about it, it does appear to be unjust that he pays the guys who worked all day long the same wage that he pays the people who only work for 20 minutes at the very end. But this is where Jesus pivots off this. He says, wait a minute, what do you mean just or unjust? This is my vineyard. This is my money. I hired you at 6 a.m. and you agreed at 6 a.m. that you would work all day in the vineyard for the set price that I agreed to pay you, whatever it was. So you're getting what you deserve. You're getting what you agreed to. We had a deal, and I'm making good on my part of the deal. So there's nothing unjust about you being paid what you agreed to be paid. And yes, you did work all day long in the hot sun, and here's your money. And because it's my vineyard, he says, and because it's my money, I can do with it what I want to do. And so the people who came in at the very end, or the people who came in earlier and didn't do as much work as the first crew did, I'm going to pay them the same amount of money because I can. And it seems to me, and this has always been sort of my reaction whenever I read and think about that incident in the Gospels, is that at first glance, it does seem to be unjust, doesn't it? But in fact, it's not a matter, it is, I should say, both a matter of justice. It's also a matter of mercy. And although the word mercy isn't used in that parable, there is a component of mercy there, because the owner of the vineyard, he is, in a sense, having mercy on those who came in and worked just a short period of time, because he's paying them far more, far, far more than their labors actually deserved. So this is where we juxtapose justice, which is you get what you deserve, and mercy, where you don't get what you deserve. So from the standpoint of mercy, the mercy that he was having on those who worked a short period of time and then got paid the full amount, the amount that the original early bird crew got, that's a form of mercy, but it appeared to be unjust to those who worked from the very beginning, because they got, you know, they're thinking, we either should get more than them, in which case it would be more than we agreed to in the first place, or they should get less than us. And of course, the analogy to this in a spiritual sense, in a real world sense, Jesus is pointing to, you know, is a variety of things. One thing, of course, is that you've got the Jews, the chosen people, the people of Israel, the sons and daughters of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, those who had been faithful and they had kept the covenant and they had observed all the requirements that God had laid down faithfully, you know, more or less faithfully, let's put it that way. They're like the ones who went in at the very beginning. And now Jesus is saying, well, salvation is here for also the Gentiles. And their natural reaction, some of them anyway, is, well, why should they get the full benefit of what you're giving to us, Jesus, when we're the ones who have been toiling in this vineyard for, lo, these last, you know, 2,000 years going back to Abraham, or 1,500 years going back to the time of Moses? Why do we have to get all, why did we have to work all this time just and get this, and they're not working hardly, they're not even doing anything. They've been living the high life, and now suddenly they're going to receive the promises that were given to us. That's one dimension of this story. Another dimension of this story, it seems to me, is this whole idea of any one of us, regardless of your religious background or lack thereof, and that is that you have people maybe who are, let's take Catholics as an example. Maybe you're a Catholic, a lifelong Catholic. You've grown up in the faith. You tried, by God's grace, to be a good person. When you fell into sin, you went to confession. You were faithful in receiving the sacraments. You went to Mass on Sunday. You did all the things that the gospel asks of you, that the church asks of you, and you've done it faithfully all these years. And then some schmo who maybe led a very dissolute life, very immoral life or corrupt life, or maybe all of the above, suddenly now he lives this life of pleasure and hedonism, and he gets religion near the end of his life. Maybe he's on his deathbed and he has a conversion, and he dies in the state of grace because he got baptized, let's say. And he gets to go straight to heaven because he lived this life of immorality and hedonism, etc. And now he's 70 years old and he's dying and he's about to die, and he's sincerely sorry for his sins. He receives baptism. His soul is perfectly clean, and off he goes. And he goes straight to heaven. Doesn't that seem a bit unfair? Well, if you look at it from an earthly standpoint, sure, of course it seems unfair. Because why did you have to toil and be faithful and do all those things that the gospel enjoins upon us as followers of Jesus? And you had to do all those things. And then, yeah, okay, you go to heaven, which is great when you die. But this guy over here, he enjoyed all the illicit things in life. He got the pleasure out of it. And then he winds up getting baptized at the very end, and he goes to heaven as well. It does seem somewhat unfair. But look at it the other direction, though. The other direction is that God is merciful. And in this case, he gives somebody what he doesn't deserve. None of us deserves heaven in any case. It's God's free gift of grace. We don't deserve it. We don't merit it. We can't earn it. The Council of Trent, FYI for your good-to-know file, in the 16th century, the Council of Trent condemned the notion that you or any of us can earn your salvation, or that you or any of us can, solely by your own natural ability, by being a nice person, for example, that you could somehow merit salvation. None of us can merit salvation. Apart from Jesus, there's no way that we can receive the gift of salvation. It's because of what Jesus did for us that we are able to receive it. And yes, there is merit in following Jesus. There is merit in, as St. Paul talks about in Romans, faith working in love, or the obedience of faith, as he also describes it in the Epistle to the Romans. So yes, there is a component to that, but this is all a free gift of God's grace, as it says in Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 9. This is by, we obtain it by faith, but it's God's grace from beginning to end. So we really, both for our faith, which is a gift, and any good works that we may perform, which are also good gifts, or also gifts rather from God, ultimately it's God's grace, not our own merits. So as I saw this story pop up yet again about the guy who lived rent-free, mortgage-free in this house for the last 23 years, it just got me to thinking about this issue of justice and mercy. And just a quick little aside from my own experience, there was a time when Nancy and I went through this. We were trying to sell a house. It was the first house we ever bought, and we outgrew it rather quickly. We bought this house in early 19, what was it, March? Something like that. I think it was like March of 1985, back in the last century. And we had two toddlers and a newborn. And we moved from a little duplex where we had just cramped quarters. So there was a little kitchen, a little living room, two little bedrooms, and a bathroom. And that was it. So when we moved out of that little duplex that we had been renting for a few years, that was, it just seemed like we had this palace now with this little two bedroom, one and a half bath house. There was actually a third room that the previous occupant was using as a kind of a dining room of sorts. So we turned that quickly into a bedroom because we needed the space. But to us, that seemed palatial when we moved into it. 1,165 square feet, by the way. I've never forgotten the square footage because to us it was like, oh, wow, there's so much room here. So we moved into that little house. It was the first house we ever bought. And we felt like, you know, emperors in our new space and had a yard for the kids to play in and such. Well, about 9 years later, now we have seven children. We're still living in that little house. And as I like to say, we're like stacked like firewood. So we had bunk beds galore and kids everywhere, but we were having a great time. But when we got to the point where we could no longer stay in that house, just physically, we no longer had the space, we had to start looking for something else. And so we did. So we tried to sell it and tried to sell it and tried to sell it, and we couldn't sell it. And it was just the market wasn't good, and our neighborhood wasn't the best neighborhood, and we didn't have any money to do what you're supposed to do, curb appeal. And we had enough money basically to make ends meet, and that was about it. And a lot of the time, we didn't even have that much money. So we did the best we could, and we got to the point where we thought, okay, we probably should try to rent this for the time being because we've spent so much time trying to sell it. It's not selling. So we're looking for renters, and lo and behold, a family says, okay, we'll rent it. And they're like, okay, whew, at least we can keep that house payment covered while we move to a bigger place, which we did. And they signed the rental lease and all that. They got maybe 3 months into that rental lease, and they just stopped paying the rent. They just stopped. And I would call them. They wouldn't take our phone calls. This is back in the day pre-voicemail. You couldn't leave a voicemail unless you had one of the fancy voicemail machines, which we didn't have, and they didn't have it because they were poor, and we were poor. So here we are in this predicament where Nancy and I, now we have seven kids, and there may have been a baby on the way. I think there was a baby on the way at that time. We didn't have the means to be able to have to support two mortgage payments, but we had to because they squatted in our house. They wouldn't leave. We sent them notices, threatening letters from the bank came in. You got to pay your rent and all this kind of thing. And of course, we were getting those letters too. So we had to continue making the payments regardless because we didn't want that to reflect badly on our credit. And so I began to kind of look into the law. Well, what is the law? And I found that the way the law is written is it's stacked in favor of the tenant, and it's difficult to evict somebody. And we had to go through all sorts of processes. Eventually, finally, after a year of these people living in our house rent-free, we finally, and I forget now, it's been so long ago, I just don't remember, but we finally were able to oust them. And we felt bad about it, but we, in a way, we didn't feel at all bad about it because they were being grossly, what's the word for it? They were just, it was grotesque how they were taking advantage of us. And they didn't seem to care that we were this big family with a lot of kids and not a lot of money. They didn't care because, hey, they had a free place to stay for a whole year. Finally, we got them out. I think it's when the sheriff got involved or whatever. So we come back to the house that we've been paying for the better part of this last year. And to add insult to injury, we found that they had trashed it. It looked like the guy had changed the transmission in the living room. The carpet was completely destroyed, holes in the wall, broken things. I won't bore you with the details, but it was heartbreaking. It was infuriating for us because, well, I mean, you can see why, because it was unjust. They didn't pay their just debt. They didn't follow through on their obligation. And they wound up costing us tens of thousands of dollars more in the damages that they had inflicted upon our little bungalow that we had to fix in order to be able to finally sell. And we did finally sell it after that, thanks be to God. It did finally sell, but we had to invest money that we didn't have to fix the house that was destroyed. So that's my little contribution to the discussion. Maybe you've been through something similar in your own life where somebody did you wrong, somebody perpetrated an injustice against you. That's where we come back to this issue of mercy. Mercy, thank God he is merciful. Don't you thank God for that? And when you look back on your life and consider your life of sin, maybe in your youth when you were younger and before you had things as figured out as you do now, you look back and you say, oh my gosh, all those things that I did, be thankful for God's mercy. Yes, I want justice for other people like you do. You want other people like that dude who squatted in that house for 23 years. You want justice for that guy. But isn't it interesting? We don't want justice for ourselves. We want mercy for ourselves. So I thank God that he is merciful. We're going to take a quick time out. We'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. If you want to send me a message on Twitter, my address there is at Patrick Madrid. Also, you can send me an email by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. You'll find the link there where you can send me an email. It comes directly to me and I read them all, and I'd love to hear from you. I'll be right back. You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principalsclasses.com/Madrid.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. Keeping it relevant.
Pure energy.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Pure energy.
And relevantradio.com.
Okay, welcome back. And again, thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. I really appreciate it. Please tell your friends about the show, and it's easy for them to listen no matter where they are in the world by using the Relevant Radio app. They can get that at the App Store if they have an iPhone, or Google Play if they're on an Android phone. Now, if they're on some other phone, try one or the other. But yeah, either way, please tell others about the show. All right. I mentioned that I love getting your emails. Not all of you agree with everything I say, and that's okay. I'm not bothered by that. I'd like to share a few of the emails that have come in recent weeks and months. This one from a listener named Cecilia. This is the note that was taken by the person at Relevant Radio that she talked about. She said she was upset because we used, I guess as a bumper that day, the song Cecilia by Simon and Garfunkel, and she's deeply offended, and she says, I hope you'll be more discerning about what you release out to the airwaves. Well, all right, let's calm things down. I'm familiar with the song, but as you'll note, we play almost always, invariably, we play only the instrumental version of the song. Now, keep in mind that if you were alive in the 1960s when that song came out, you would know the song. And maybe if you listened to an oldie station in the years since then, you might hear it. But I guarantee you, Cecilia, that very few people under the age of, say, probably under the age of 50, have ever even heard that song. They don't know what the song is. And as is true with many songs, if you like the melody or the lyric, or I'm sorry, if you like the melody, that's one thing. And maybe there are aspects of the song that are not so good. But we don't play, more often than not, we don't play lyrics in the song. We just simply play the melody because it has a good energy or so forth. So I think you are being a little overly sensitive on this issue. And believe me, we are very discerning about what we put out on the airwaves. So I'm sorry that you didn't feel happy about the song Cecilia, but that's the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. This email comes in from, and I, you know, for some reason, these particular emails don't have names associated with them. I don't know why. I guess they're just sort of edited without the name. But this one comes in from a listener saying, "Hi, Patrick. For the most part, I enjoy listening to your show. Tonight, I was surprised that you're encouraging Catholics to be defiant / rebellious with the law if it imposes restrictions on us, like not being able to go to church. Haven't we already seen enough shootings and killings with people defying the law, including the era with Martin Luther King? Why encourage defiance?" I have no earthly clue what you're talking about. I encourage people all the time, at least whenever the issue comes up, to be nonviolent. Now, you're saying defiance, and maybe because you invoke this idea of shootings and killings in people defying the law with the era of Martin Luther King. If you're talking about Martin Luther King's commitment to nonviolent resistance against unjust laws, well, yeah. And I'm shocked that you don't feel the same way. The last thing on earth I would ever encourage anyone to do is to be violent against others. And I have a very, I would say, in my own self-defense, I've got a strong track record on that. And anytime the issue has ever come up, you will always hear me say exactly that. But there is a time when you do have to defy unjust laws. You have to at times. I mean, our whole country, the United States of America, was established on that premise that when the Crown of England began doing things that were considered intolerable by the colonists, they had the right, in their desire to be autonomous, they had a right to rebel against that, and they did, and that's how this country was born. It was born in revolution. Some revolutions are necessary. Many revolutions are bloody and terrible, especially of the communist variety, but not all revolutions are bad things, as evidenced by the birth of the United States. Furthermore, you invoke Martin Luther King. I don't understand your thinking on this issue, because look at what Martin Luther King did. He resisted. He was defiant against the racist laws of this country. And he championed a form of resistance that was very successful. You didn't know it was going to be successful at first. When black people wanted to sit in the seat that they had taken on the bus, and some white person gets on the bus and says, "Hey, give me that seat. You have to go sit in the back of the bus." Those were incidents that conformed to the Jim Crow laws of the day, where there were whites-only drinking fountains and other drinking fountains or other restrooms or other places in restaurants where black people could eat, but they couldn't eat or drink or use the restroom that was reserved for whites. These were terrible vestiges of slavery, these Jim Crow laws. And so Martin Luther King and the other people, like the Freedom Riders, they were right to resist them. So, I mean, with all due respect, I don't know how much of that history you're aware of. Maybe you're not aware of it. But the whole point of Martin Luther King resisting these unjust laws was as a way to overthrow them. So that's why I would encourage resistance or defiance against an unjust law. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not saying don't pay your taxes. I'm not saying resist the government in matters that are reasonable or matters that are just. I'm just saying if, let's say, it got to the point where a government in any given country said, "You're not allowed to practice your Catholic faith anymore," yeah, absolutely, I'm going to resist that. Does that mean that I would sneak out at night to go to Mass in the middle of a forest in a barn if that's what was necessary? Yeah, sure, I would do that. If the government were to say, like it happened in China, "Sorry, you can only have one child, and if you have more than one child, we're going to forcibly abort that child," I would do everything possible to resist that. And it may not be possible to do so. Look at the poor people in China who had to live under that disastrous law. I mean, if I had the means to be able to get out from under a situation like that and move to a country where those laws were not in place, I would do so. That would be a form of defiance. So you have to understand there's a time and place where you have to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm thinking of the story of the mother and her seven sons, Second Maccabees. And they were told by the king, a pagan, that you have to eat pork. Here, have this BLT. I'm sorry, we can't do that. It's got pork in it. We'll do it anyway, because if you don't eat the pork, I'm going to kill you. And the way that we kill you is not going to be particularly pleasant. Sorry, we can't eat that. That's forbidden to us under the Mosaic law. And so the mother watched as each of her seven sons died very painful, horrible deaths. And it's an example of how at times you have to resist unjust laws. That's all. That's it. That's the whole thing. Now, you'll notice in the story of the mother and her seven sons that, you know, none of the sons lunged for a sword to try to fight against the soldiers or anybody. They would have lost in any case. They didn't resort to violence. And that's what I've been preaching and saying all along. Nonviolence. That's what Martin Luther King was all about. And look, he won. He won. And the civil rights laws in this country were enacted as a way to enshrine his and the other civil rights activists at that time, to enshrine their victory in law. So I hope you'll consider it from that standpoint. This one comes in. Now, these are all coming in, I'm afraid, without any particular name attached to it. So if this is your letter, you'll know it when you hear it. So this person writes in saying, please, this is in caps, do not use this term, el presidente. It is highly offensive. In America, we speak the king's English and refer to our president as Mr. President. We take pride in our American heritage, the good and the bad. And when we hear people using language in public other than English, it deeply offends. Well, Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. El presidente is simply the president in Spanish. And there are a whole lot of people in this country, I'm one of them, who speak Spanish. And to refer to the president as el presidente is in no way offensive, unless you're reading into it something that you shouldn't be. I don't know what that might be. So it's not offensive. It's not intended to be offensive. It is a way of referring in a different language to the same thing. And from time to time, this pops up where people get their feathers ruffled. And why do you say el presidente? What do you mean by that? What are you trying to say? Well, I'm trying to say el presidente. Say it after me, everybody. Cyrus, say it. El presidente. It just means the president. That's all it means. And ease up, okay? Ease up. Take a chill pill, as my kids used to say back in the day. Take a chill pill. Don't leap to unwarranted conclusions. Don't assume bad motives. Just recognize that that's a way to refer to the president, whoever he may be. And I've referred to President Reagan as el presidente. I've referred to Barack Obama as el presidente. I referred to Donald Trump as el presidente. I've referred to now Joe Biden as el presidente. Equal opportunity, and that's all it is. Don't make a mountain out of a molehill, is my point. And by the way, when you say that when you hear people using language in public other than English, you know what? Get used to it. Get used to it. This is a multiracial, multi-ethnic country that we live in. And you've got people from all corners of the globe who hopefully at least are assimilating and learning English and taking part in this national experiment of being Americans. But we are enriched by all of the different cultures that come here and the languages that come with them. So I'm sorry, sir or madam, this is something up with which I will not put. And I hope you'll understand. Here's another one. You smeared Joel Osteen by name on nationwide radio. But do you ever call out by name the corrupt leaders in the Catholic Church? Probably not. Because I heard you say that it is not your role and let God sort it out. So why don't you concentrate on criticizing your own church and stop slamming televangelists like Joel Osteen? I'm reading it the way I think the person who wrote it was probably feeling when they wrote this. Cyrus and I affectionately call these nasty grams. Okay, check it out. First of all, I just happened to hear that same segment on the program that was replayed, I guess it was in the evening. So I was kind of dipping in here and there to hear what was going on. And I caught that segment. I listened to it all over again. And you need to do the same thing, sir or madam, with all due respect. What you will hear, if you go back and listen to it, is a gentleman called up and he said, you know, I listened to Joel Osteen. I mean, we're Catholic. We go to Mass, etc. But we listened to Joel Osteen. And I said very little about him at all. And he's the one who raised that man's name. What I said specifically about Joel Osteen is I said to him, I said, why would you listen to that when it's just happy talk? It's happy talk, empty calories, I think I might have said. Now, the balance of the discussion was not about Joel Osteen. And I know this for a fact because I went back and listened to the whole thing from top to bottom. And your criticism is misplaced for this reason. Because I branched off from that and I was no longer talking about Joel Osteen. I said, I want to refer here now to the health and wealth prosperity preachers and how they corrupt or they distort the meaning of faith. And I talked about them as a group. I was not talking about Joel Osteen, and I was not smearing him, as you say, incorrectly. And for that matter, do I ever talk about corrupt leaders in the church? Absolutely. Now, I don't know how much you've been listening to the program, and you know that's understandable if you haven't listened to much of the program. I certainly understand that. But I would invite you to go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you can pull up all kinds of examples. And you can do a word search for that matter, and look at all the examples in which I discuss malfeasance in the church and things of that nature. So, yeah, it is there. As I say, I'm equal opportunity. I try not to dwell on the failings of other people. I mean, I don't like it when people dwell on my failings. So I try to avoid dwelling on other people's failings, that's for sure. But in the meantime, you know, I have to answer the question. And the guy asked me a question. What do you think about the health and wealth prosperity preachers? And I gave my opinion on that matter, and I stand by my words. And I realize that maybe perhaps you have an attachment to Joel Osteen. Fair enough. But I think he's empty calories and pretty much just a bunch of happy talk. And I don't apologize for my comments. So if you want to hear them again in context and listen closely, I think you'll see that you overreacted to what I had to say. That's my take on this issue. You may differ from me. That's fine. I don't mind. We're going to take a quick break, and we will come back to more of the Patrick Madrid Show right here on Relevant Radio. So please stay right there. I'm coming right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values, and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we're back. And as you might imagine, I have quite a backlog of your messages that have come in, and I read every single one of them. I'm grateful for each one of them, and I thank you for taking the time, whether you agree with me or not. Even if you're angry when you write the email, I do appreciate the fact that you've taken time out of your busy day to communicate with me, so thank you for that. We may not always agree, and I may tell you so in my response to something that you've sent in, but please know that I do value taking your time to share these with me. So I've got a big old mailbag here. I want to get through a few more of these. Susan in Oregon, she says, Patrick, I've been listening to you by podcast since the beginning of the pandemic. Even our two boys, 14 and 16, very much enjoy listening. They've even said, turn it back on when it was time for me to turn the radio off. Oh boy, Susan, there's never a time to turn the radio off if you ask me. Just keep it purring quietly in the background. You never know. So the boys say, turn it back on when it was time to turn the radio off. That says a lot for your teaching, what you are teaching and the style. Thank you. Thank you for your show. It is not uncommon for me to download your podcasts and listen to them when I'm working outside on our farm. That's cool. You've kept me company and helped me grow in my faith and knowledge of our beautiful Catholic faith. God's blessing to you and to your crew there at Relevant Radio. Boy, we sure appreciate that. Yeah, we take our fair share of incoming, again, as Cyrus and I affectionately call them, nasty grams. But, you know, live and learn. So it's nice to know that as you're out there working on the farm, I don't know what kind of farm it is, but I can only imagine. If we're there to help keep you company, that's great. Bill writes in from Helena, Montana. He says, Relevant Radio is life-changing. I started listening regularly in the summer of 2020. It has been instrumental in bringing me back to the faith. After 35 years, I fell away from the church in my early teens while I was baptized as a Catholic and had my first reconciliation and first communion. I was never confirmed. Now I'm back in a parish and am starting RCIA this fall. Because of Relevant Radio, among other things, God has given me to build my faith recently. I'm home. Oh, what two awesome words those are. He says, I'm home, and Relevant Radio is the key in my growing faith every day. That is awesome. Bill, thank you for sharing that with us. I really appreciate it. Now, I'd like to pivot on that, because it just so happens that not too long ago, I got a different kind of message from somebody on Twitter. She said, listening to Patrick Madrid just reminds me why I left the church. Somebody with a self-righteous, condescending tone who insists that any and all opinions that go against the church are some sort of logical fallacy and therefore not true. Talk about tolerant. Well, I retweeted that because I figure, what the heck, you know, other people may feel the same way. But I was pleased to see that a number of people, listeners to the program, they, for the most part, they said that they didn't agree with her. But it's interesting, another person chimed in and said, I couldn't agree more. He and Relevant Radio spout one view and never look at the other different sides. Never is it a fair, unbiased discussion. Very frustrating. And when someone tries to give another view, he or she is blocked or told they are wrong. Grr. Oh, boy. All right. Well, then the lady who posted the first one that I just quoted a moment ago, she says, I like that everyone who responded to my tweet basically heard it as Patrick made me leave the church. Nope. Blatant hypocrisy made me leave the church. I was molested as a child, she says. That's terrible, and I'm so sorry to hear that. She says, as a result, I have a hard time listening, a hard time of putting any stock or faith into an organization that, and this is a two-part message, that decides the best method is to, chalk it all off, that's what she means, to the infallibility of man and just shuffle them around so they are free to do it again and again and again in perpetuity. I love Jesus, but his friends are blank. I can't say the word online. Poor thing. And I don't mean that in a condescending way. I really feel very sad for you. First of all, that you were molested. What a horrible thing. I hope that whoever did that to you was brought to justice. But it's interesting that her original email, she didn't say, well, she kind of did say that I, maybe not personally, was the reason that she left the church. So she said, listening to Patrick Madrid just reminds me why I left the church. And then she goes on to, I guess, describe me in her own view. She says, somebody with a self-righteous, condescending tone who insists that any and all opinions that go against the church are some sort of a logical fallacy and therefore not true. Talk about tolerant. So she's defending herself in the next tweet by saying, I didn't say Patrick made me leave the church. Blatant hypocrisy made me leave the church. Well, I guess maybe that you're saying then that you think I'm being blatantly hypocritical. So I would ask you if you want to call in. But of course, you're not listening to the show. Or maybe you are, because you wouldn't have posted this if you hadn't been listening. So there's an upside there. At least you are listening. Her name is Brittany, by the way. So, Brittany, if you hear this, please know that I would welcome a conversation with you on the phone, on the show, if you ever want to do that. But if you hate my guts, so be it. I understand. Sometimes that happens, and there's nothing I can do about it. But I guarantee you one thing. I have talked countless times on this program against the very hypocrisy that you're talking about. Now, if you think I'm hypocritical, well, then there's probably not much I can do to change your mind on that. But if you're referring to hypocrisy in the church, cardinals and bishops and priests and others, for example, who, as you said, shuttled priests around, are free to do it again, I've spoken out very strongly against that. I think any normal good person would do that. And I've done it many times on this program. So the one thing I have to say in your comment that is patently false is I definitely don't hold the view that any opinion that goes against the church is some sort of a, quote, logical fallacy. Sometimes people do fall into logical fallacies in the way they try to argue about something, and if I can point that out, I will. But I don't, by definition, just assume that somebody who has a disagreement with the Catholic Church is using logical fallacies. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. My view is, let's discuss it and see where the truth lies. And as Jesus said to St. Peter, sometimes the truth lies in a direction that you do not want to go. He's referring there to St. Peter's martyrdom, where he would be bound and led away to be executed. That was a prophetic statement on the part of Jesus. So if I remind you of why you left the Catholic Church and yet you're still listening, Brittany, I count that as a win. And I hope you'll keep listening. And Sharon, who responded to her on Twitter, who says, couldn't agree more. He and Relevant Radio spout one view and never look at another different sides. You know what's odd about that, Sharon? Because you say that we spout one view, and I notice you say spout. So why is it that I'm spouting a view? Am I not allowed to just like have a view? And when I present my case, 3 hours a day, Monday through Friday, open lines, anyone can call in and disagree with me. How is it that I'm spouting a view? That, of course, is loaded language. I mean, wouldn't it be a little bit more fair to say that I'm presenting my view, or I have a view, or I'm sharing my view? Why must you call it spouting my view? I guess you're spouting your view, if we apply the same logic. But in any case, here's my question about your post to Brittany. You say, he, referring to me, and Relevant Radio spout one view and never look at the other different sides. I got to stop you right there. That is patently false. If you listen to this show for any length of time, and it sounds like you have because you're commenting about it, we take phone calls from practically any particular perspective you can imagine. People who hotly disagree with me, people who give their opinions that are contrary to my own, and we have a discussion here. So it's not only not true, it's also not fair. I think you're being disingenuous when you say this. Never, she says, is it a fair, unbiased discussion. Also not true. Also not true. We have atheist folk. We have non-Catholic folk of all stripes. We have people who are Catholic and they disagree with my view on things from time to time. And everyone here is welcomed. Everyone knows that. And so I don't know what you mean by an unbiased discussion. You say it's never a fair, unbiased discussion. Well, what could make it more fair and more unbiased than for me to invite commentary and calls in real time where I can't control it other than I'm, you know, I have to respect the breaks we have to go to. So there is a certain time limit. How else could it be more fair and more unbiased than the way we do it here on this program? You say it's very frustrating. Well, what are you frustrated about? You say it's very frustrating, and when someone tries to give another view, he or she is blocked or told they are wrong. Okay. Well, when you say blocked, maybe you're referring to Twitter. So let me explain that part to you. When somebody is rude, and I don't mean just merely rude, but when somebody becomes offensively rude and uses four-letter words or is always attacking, and there are some people, Sharon, maybe you're one of them, I don't know. We'll see. I'll monitor your behavior, and we'll determine at some future point whether I'll need to block you or not. But when somebody becomes abusive, as a number of people do, or they're always, always critical, they're always trying to take pot shots, life's too short. I don't want to deal with that kind of thing. So yeah, do I block somebody who is constantly obnoxious, constantly using profanity, constantly trying to launch tirades online? Yeah, I do. And I'm not the least bit repentant about that. Life's too short, and I don't have time to babysit people who do that, Sharon. I don't know if you do, but I don't. So when someone tries to give another view, I don't mind. I'm happy to interact with people, especially on the show. But if you're going to be obnoxious about it or use profanity or in some other way be very hateful, yeah, you'll get blocked. Now, I'm not saying that to you personally. I'm just saying that generically. And as I say, I will monitor your behavior. And if you go down that road, and I hope you won't, then you can expect to be blocked. But if you just want to interact with me in a calm, rational way, then great. We can have all kinds of conversations. So There we have it. There's plenty more by way of commentary and emails. Let's see if we can round it out on a nice note. A couple of nice notes. This one is, let's see. This is from, I don't know if it's Sandra or Sanda, listening in San Diego, who says, I am not a Catholic, but I am very passionate, and I'm a very passionate listener to Relevant Radio. I used to listen to other Christian stations for years and always enjoyed them, but they're nothing like Relevant Radio and nothing like your show. You are the best, she says. Thank you. The way you talk, the way you answer questions, the way you are interacting with listeners, it shows who you really are. It's one thing to say I'm a Christian. It's another thing to be qualified for that title. She says, you are 100%. I would never be able to find the right words to express my respect and passion for your shows. She goes on in that vein. I thank you for all the kind words. She says, I just want to tell you all that I pray for you and for your team and for your family because God has created such an amazing thing with the show. Well, thank you, Sandra. I do appreciate that more than you know. And all of us here at Relevant Radio, we do appreciate that. Thank you. That's a nice way to go out. No.